Hello, my name is David McIntosh, National Co-Chairman of the Federalist Society. Welcome to our conference on legal systems in transition, new directions for Eastern Europe. It's my pleasure to introduce our conference chairman, Professor Alan Weinstein, who's also president of the Center for Democracy. Alan is a close friend and somebody who I admire greatly. He's dedicated his life to making sure that some of the principles that we hold dear here in the United States have a chance to spring up and take root around the world when people try to adopt democratic institutions. Alan also is quite well known for a book that he wrote early in his life called Perjury, the Hiss Chambers Case, where he challenged some of the assumptions of the liberal orthodoxy in the United States and was quite brave in defending what he saw to be the truth there. So I welcome Alan, who will be our chairman and guide us through these events.
Thank you, David. General Thornburg, Governor. I never know what to call Lieutenant Governor, so I'll call Lieutenant Governor General, Governor, I guess, and Mr. Cook, ladies and gentlemen. When Pavel Hrušetsky and I met with President Havel in Prague the other day, where, among other things, I extended an invitation that was given to me by the organizers of this conference for President Havel to speak via satellite at this gathering, for which, unfortunately, arrangements could not be made in time, I had occasion to discuss the nature of the conference and other things that were happening with one of President Havel's aides, at which point he turned to me and said, please, stop now. Don't press this or we will have even more problems. The president will want to go in the deputy prime minister's place, and we need him here, and he'll say better next week there than in Central or Eastern Europe at the moment. And that is a theme that you'll hear more of in the next 15 minutes. Those preparing to ride the roller coaster of democracy should be warned in advance to expect abrupt twists and turns and to budget for the hard bumps. Our friends in Central and Eastern Europe have begun to learn this lesson. Everywhere, the recognition is painful once the initial euphoria related to becoming democratic begins to subside. A year ago at this time, we in the West watched our television screens nightly for new and compelling evidence of the dramatic Euroquake then unfolding, which brought the collapse of communism throughout much of Central and Eastern Europe. We were not disappointed. A Polish military patriarch negotiated a clumsy power-sharing arrangement with his Solidarity adversaries. In Hungary, a communist government drafted the ground rules for its own demise. In Prague, the Velvet Revolution street demonstrations brought a playwright to power, while dynastic communism lost one of its luminaries in Romania after a bloody struggle involving warring factions among his own followers. Within the Soviet Union itself, power began to fracture along legislative, republic, and municipal fault lines as the empire's identity crisis entered its terminal phase, and, of course, the wall came tumbling down. Earlier this fall in Leningrad, I spoke along with others from throughout Europe and the United States at a human rights conference co-sponsored by Solidarity, by the city of Vilnius, and by the city of Leningrad. A deeply moving occasion for someone like myself, a first-generation American whose parents had fled Tsarist tyranny before World War I. This gathering of activists exemplified, moreover, one of the fundamental dilemmas of the democratic movement today throughout Central and Eastern Europe. Although many of the participants, especially those from various nationality groups within the Soviet Union, were still struggling to achieve rights denied to adversaries of the existing regime, a number of others already governed. They governed countries, as in the case of Solidarity and the delegates from Hungary and the Czech and Slovak Federative Republic and Lithuania. They governed cities, as in the case of mayors Popov and Sobchak, and they governed republics of the Soviet Union, as in the case of Boris Yeltsin and others who were there. When friends or others whom I know well shift their status from opposition leaders to rulers of democratizing countries, I normally send them a simple telegram. Now the hard part begins. Whether in the United States or elsewhere, the old cliche holds true. We do campaign in poetry, but we do govern in prose. In whatever country, campaigners for human rights who have experienced the poetic stuff of heroic epics, jail terms, exile, torture, killings, only to survive and triumph, often discover that the tedious process of developing democratic institutions in non-democratic societies can be a living hell. The daily struggle to construct new constitutions or law codes, new procedures for governance, to build market-driven economies from the wreckage of planned catastrophes, however essential to the stability and prosperity of democracies, can rarely be called heroic, poetic, or epic. More normally, it is unsexy, unpopular, and even uninteresting, at least to those who have become accustomed to living in a state of perpetual crisis and confrontation. Such is the reality for new democracies. Take the case of Poland, now in the midst of a debilitating struggle for power within its Solidarity leadership. Imagine the fate of the American Republic in the 1780s if instead of a unifying constitution and virtual coalition government in our initial years, there had been a presidential contest between, say, Washington, Jefferson, and an emigre hat maker from Marseille named Tominski, with all the other founders forced to take stands. I still can't get the name straight, you see. In addition, Poland, as it approaches the crucial 200th anniversary of its liberal constitution of 1791, does not yet have its new constitution fully prepared or approved, nor does it have a parliament whose members have been fully democratically elected. Turning to Hungary, the fabric of civil society and consensus has been perilously strained through a combination of recent political and economic abrasions. The Czechs and the Slovaks, meanwhile, continue their constitutional kabuki drama, and whether their remarkable playwright president and his talented colleagues, such as my friend the Deputy Prime Minister, Mr. Rushetsky, and others, can write a satisfactory federal ending to the drama is an open question. Romania remains mired in a savage internal melodrama of lies and self-deceptions, while Bulgaria staggers toward non-communist but uncertain governance. As for the Soviet Union, what Soviet Union? Whose Soviet Union? The country of Yeltsin and over a dozen republics clamoring for immediate sovereignty over armies and economic resources within their territories? The country of Gorbachev and his government taking on emergency powers with no assurances that the army, the KGB, and the nomenklatura will provide unfettered background, backing? The country of the numerous mini-republics and ethno-cultural groupings scrunched uncomfortably next to one another, each demanding immediate fulfillment of rights and national claims that often go back to earlier centuries. In this overheated labyrinth, at a moment of global crisis in the Gulf and of possible civil strife within the Soviet Union itself, a sympathetic American may be forgiven a gentle inquiry: who's in charge and how can you tell? We can only hope that a situation which in so many ways appears programmed for near-term tragedy can muddle along with mere monumental chaos and confusion. If we step back from the day-to-day cyclone of political change that has swept the world in the last generation, we can detect three essential phases of U.S. policy response identified with specific administrations. Under the Carter administration, the Human Rights Bureau of the State Department became a driving engine of policymaking toward a number of offending countries, both in this hemisphere and elsewhere. Even earlier, during the Ford-Kissinger interregnum, the signing of the Helsinki Accords with their Basket III provisions set the stage for legitimizing international intervention in the human rights field throughout the Soviet Empire and within each country of that empire. Phase one human rights efforts remain critical today, as they must, redefined to meet a spectrum of national situations throughout the world. The Reagan administration added, beginning with the president's historic 1982 speech to the British Parliament, a compatible yet distinctive initiative to encourage the development of democratic political institutions, beginning with support for free elections, the creation of civic cultures through such entities as the National Endowment for Democracy, or by expanding the efforts of AID and USIA, and the Voice of America, and Radio Free Europe, and Radio Liberty, and frankly, just as importantly, by an aggressive style of activist and unapologetic campaigning for democracy. I'm pleased to see Ed Meese here. He had a very large role in all of that. All of this effort soon transcended targets within the communist world to encompass unfree societies elsewhere. Phase two policies, like those of phase one, continue to expand, as they should, but it is time to move on to construct phase three, in many ways the most difficult phase of American policy toward a democratizing world. If phase one involved the insistence upon Western democratic human rights standards in a largely non-democratic world, and phase two involved or has pressed vigorously for transitions from autocratic to democratic political institutions, phase three involves the consolidation of those institutions and of free market economies during the decade ahead. A new global paradigm, to coin a phrase, with its current epicenter squarely in the region under discussion at this conference. Phase three requires a complete rethinking of the nature and deployment of our available national resources in both governmental and non-governmental sectors. Every person in this room can point to success stories in support of new democracies, ranging from Spain and Portugal to Uruguay and Chile to the Philippines and to a dozen other countries, when decisive support from the outside was not necessarily costly and massive, it was only intelligent, timely, and effective. Americans in our present national condition must enter the lists as champions of democracy and of market economies in Central and Eastern Europe more, in short, as lees than as grants, using our experience and our wits at least as much as our resources and our power in devising creative ways to assist the new governments and the non-governmental leaders of the region. This gathering could not be timelier, ladies and gentlemen. We meet at a moment of crisis and consolidation, a pivotal moment for the newly freed countries of Central and Eastern Europe, when the painful realities of institutional remodeling threaten to undermine the fragile coalitions of liberty lovers who fill these days our nightly television screens less with their bright hopes than with their bleak problems. One of history's harshest but not most inexorable laws, from my perspective, is the law of unintended consequences. And the recent changes in Central and Eastern Europe have begun to produce their share. Throughout the region, for example, a disturbing resurgence of ancient religious, ethnic, and cultural divisions has accompanied the movement toward multi-party pluralism, assisting in the development of appropriate federal structures to assure the rights of minorities, while still encouraging national cohesion, remains and should remain an essential task for Americans engaged in the democracy business during the 1990s, a challenge especially for jurists and lawyers and constitutional specialists such as those in this room. Nor should Americans sit back and observe and simply observe idly or tolerantly while political leaders in the new democracies, not the major ones, but some would-be political leaders, spout racist or anti-Semitic or ultra-nationalistic rhetoric. We need not become daily scolds of another culture's evolving political decorum to make it plain that we have no greater toleration for such attitudes under friendly governments than we did under communist tyranny. In this respect, there are special historical concerns regarding some Central and Eastern European countries or national entities that I need not elaborate here. Political instability plagues the process of opening up the former East Bloc to freedom, whether in the case of Poland's Mr. Tominski, who a month ago with astonishing speed became the diaspora Pole candidate for the presidency, or in yesterday's collapse of the Lukyanov transition communist-led government in Bulgaria, or in the ongoing Constitution Union Treaty arm wrestle between the forces led by Mikhail Gorbachev's advocates of strong centralism and those backing Boris Yeltsin and the other republics in calling for a new and far more greatly decentralized Soviet Union. Other countries in the region also suffer from this still incomplete process of re-legitimizing governance in Central and Eastern Europe. Some of the instability and destabilizing activity, however, I'm sad to say, has been caused by the activities either of unreconciled communist elements within those countries, we can expect that, or by a small handful of diaspora groups. And I urge any of you with influence over such groups, none of which I need mention here, to please tell them that there are governments in those areas that have enough problems without people in these groups trying to destabilize them. Economic uncertainty now is also endemic to the region, all the more so after the public repudiation and political collapse of the Mazowiecki government in Poland, which tried to move quickly and decisively from command to market economics. In the absence of convertible currencies, investment capital, restrained workforces, entrepreneurial traditions, constitutional underpinnings, new legal structures, and a continuity of government and bureaucracy supportive of foreign investment, to name only a few of the elements missing in one or another degree from most of the countries we deal with this weekend. Incentives for first-rate long-term international investment by individuals or corporations remain far from adequate, to say the least. Under the circumstance, the fact that a number of Western European and U.S. companies have already undertaken or are about to undertake major long-term commitments in the region suggests, in addition to any specific market advantages, the compelling attractiveness, despite the problems, of the region's renaissance, akin, if you will, to the old definition of second marriages, namely the triumph of hope over experience. In this area, precisely, the linking of support for democratic political rights and for individual economic opportunity lies at the heart of the matter under discussion this weekend. If a phase three strategy, a new global paradigm, is to have any immediate relevance, surely it is in assisting our friends now in Central and Eastern Europe in ways that help them to create the credible prospect for economic as well as political empowerment of the region's aspiring population. To struggle, in short, against substitution by popularly elected governments there of a protectionist, ultranationalist, xenophobic, ethnocentric statism in place of the previous Soviet-dominated, totalitarian, internationalist, colonial statism. All too often in this connection, it is worth remembering that commentators misstate the actual words of George Santayana's familiar aphorism. Those who will not learn from the past, Santayana noted, are destined to fulfill the past, whether by repetition or by continuity. Nothing is more vital for the countries of Central and Eastern Europe if they are to avoid the tragic irony of fulfilling this anti-individualistic destiny under democratic auspices and to address effectively all of their problems than setting in place soon and thoroughly a constitutional and legal framework for present and future freedoms, economic and political. This weekend, the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies has gathered here in New Orleans a cross-section of distinguished jurists, lawyers, scholars, and public figures from the United States and the various countries of Central and Eastern Europe to pursue a critical examination of the status of law and government generally in these countries, and more specifically, the themes of executive and legislative structure, property rights, environmental policy, the judiciary, the rule of law, federalism, and separatism in the new governments. I was honored by the Federalist Society's invitation to serve as conference chairman, and as chairman, therefore, I officially call the conference to order. Before concluding, one final note, I wish to raise a note of concern about American response. If the United States, its government, its private sector, and its people, fail to rise to the historic occasion now before us in Central and Eastern Europe, and to support with both economic resources and intellectual resourcefulness the Herculean labor is now confronting our friends there, whether for reasons of supposedly greater or more urgent priorities, domestic or foreign, or just plain inattention and lack of constancy, we will pay a heavy price as a nation, politically, economically, and morally, for that failure. The test of a civilized intelligence, F. Scott Fitzgerald once wrote, is the ability to keep two opposed ideas in the mind simultaneously while retaining the capacity to function. Two or more, I would add. For example, the Gulf crisis, certainly. For example, our internal economic woes, certainly. But nevertheless, we have a sacred obligation to respond adequately as a nation to the events in Central and Eastern Europe today with the same clarity and determination, for example, displayed in recent months by Chancellor Helmut Kohl in seeking German reunification. Chancellor Kohl is quoted in today's Wall Street Journal, observing that in the case of his mission, it had to be, quote, rushed through, for Gorbachev might be ousted and the democracy Europe movement in Europe disrupted. Kohl told Mr. Bush last summer, he, Kohl, was acting like a farmer who had cut hay, but now had to get it into the barn before a thunderstorm ruined the harvest. I don't know if the situation will be the same tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, he said in an interview at the time. This is, as it were, a moment in history. You have to have a smell, a sense for it. This is about the broader moment. There is about the broader moment in history underway in Central and Eastern Europe, ladies and gentlemen, the same sense, even smell, noted by the Chancellor. Therefore, we must use these 2 days of discussion wisely. We must help to bring into the barn some of that new hay, and at the same time to think clearly and practically about how best to clean out the barn itself. Thank you. It's now my privilege to introduce the Louisiana chapter president of the Federalist Society, Harvey Cook, who, in addition to his legal attainments, as all of you know, has been the spearhead of this extraordinary effort, this remarkable hosting of the conference that we are now participating in. Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Dr. Weinstein, and welcome to all of you to Louisiana and to New Orleans. To say that it is a great privilege for New Orleans to host this conference has to be the understatement of the century. Louisiana and New Orleans has a great heritage of its own in the law, and we welcome you in that spirit. We have fabulous law schools in Louisiana, and we also have the CODL system, which makes us very highly related to all of Europe and our legal system. So we have a special interest, and then to know that New Orleans has been chosen as the place for this incredibly important discussion, this moment in history, as Dr. Weinstein said, is an incredible opportunity for us, and it is not lost on us. And any work that we put into it has been more than a pleasure. It is a great pleasure to welcome you here. We hope that you will enjoy being in New Orleans. We have ordered specially good weather for you. You've noticed that, and we hope to hang on to it until Monday. We hope we can stay that long. To help me welcome you to Louisiana, I would like to introduce you to another lawyer, Lieutenant Governor Paul Hardy, who is not only a fine lawyer, but has served as our Secretary of State and is doing a wonderful job as our Lieutenant Governor, and he has come here especially today to give you a welcome to the state. Lieutenant Governor.
Bonjour, Monsieur et Madame. Je vous dis tout bienvenue à l'État de la Louisiane, la plus belle État des États-Unis, dans la belle ville de la Nouvelle-Orléans. Now I hope I have your attention. Harvey, thank you very much. During the week, Harvey said that that you were having this seminar today and asked if I was going to be able to come and greet you and welcome you to Louisiana and to New Orleans. And then he told me that General Thornburg was going to be here, so I changed my entire schedule to be sure that I was not going to miss somebody who was really important coming down to New Orleans. Last night I was at a Christmas dedication where we had 1.2 million lights that were going to be lit in celebration of our Christmas season. And with each speaker, the audience got a little bit more perturbed about, cut out the speeches, we want to see the lights. And we're going to give you the lights with the general very shortly, but I just want to let you know that you are welcomed into our great state of Louisiana. As my dear friend Harvey told you, we are slightly different from any other state in the United States, and every other state in the United States is slightly different from each other. And therefore, with the mid-European countries and Central European countries who are going to be developing from communism, thank goodness, to a democracy, we want to encourage all of you to realize that you are going to maintain your own uniqueness regardless of what type of democracy that you ultimately create for the benefit of your respective people. And we hope you the greatest success. And we thank you for choosing New Orleans as the location where you're going to begin this energetic brain wave to make it a success, to make Americans even prouder of our great democratic system, as we are proud to be Louisianians, as we are proud to receive you here today. Now we're ready for the lights, but before we give you the lights, I would like to make a slight presentation, because whenever somebody really important comes to Louisiana, we always have them to sign this book, so that when I go back home and I tell all of my people in Cajun country, which is French-speaking Cajun country, and the rest of the state of Louisiana, that we really had some important people to come here besides Harvey Cook and Paul Hardy, we have to show them the signature. So at this moment, I would like to ask General Thornburg to please rise and come and sign this book that we shall keep for posterity to show all of the important people who have visited in Louisiana, at least for as long as I was Lieutenant Governor. And General, just so that you will keep a good memory of Louisiana, we'd like to present this to you. This is a small token that we would like for you to open it so that these good folks could see exactly what it is and how you will remember Louisiana.
Merci, Monsieur le Gouverneur.
Ah, c'est magnifique! While he's opening the gift, I want to let you know quickly that you're one of 24 million people who are visiting the state of Louisiana this year, and 88% of you will return. The main reason that you will return is because of the cuisine. The second major reason you will return is because of our entertainment, our joie de vivre, our Superdome, our French Quarter, and our great American Aquarium of Americas that's just now open in New Orleans. In addition to that, General, keep time, Louisiana time. Come back and see us. Thank you all very much, and God bless all of you.
I promise to be brief so that there won't be further delay before we get to the received light and wisdom here. It's my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, Attorney General Dick Thornburgh. You all know his background, U.S. Attorney, Assistant Attorney General in the Ford Administration for the Criminal Division, twice elected Governor of Pennsylvania, and since 1988, serving as the 76th Attorney General of the United States. Attorney General Thornburgh is no stranger to the Federalist Society. A little over a month after he was confirmed as Attorney General, he spoke to our Conference on Criminal Law in Washington, where he spoke to the stressed the need for vigorous enforcement of the criminal law, especially in the war on drugs. Last January, he graciously co-chaired our Conference on Separation of Powers, where he discussed the importance of maintaining the President's independent constitutional authority. In the last 2 years, it's become increasingly clear just how important Attorney General Thornburgh is to this administration. The President relies upon Attorney General Thornburgh to guard his constitutional authorities and vigorously defend them in the courts and with Congress. He does so daily in the war on drugs, when he sends American troops to apprehend General Noriega, when questions arise about the War Powers Act vis-a-vis the Gulf, and when the President resists legislation through the use of his veto power. In the area of civil rights, President Bush also relies upon Attorney General Thornburgh to ensure that we have a vigorous enforcement of the civil rights laws and that those laws serve to end discrimination in our land. But the President also relies upon him to resist efforts to use the banner of civil rights to create a quota system in our country. Attorney General has led the Department of Justice efforts to provide the vital support for the President in all of these actions. He has also represented the United States abroad in an effort to communicate the importance of the rule of law. In the fall of 1989, just before the Berlin Wall came tumbling down and the democratic revolution swept through Eastern Europe, Attorney General Thornburgh traveled to the Soviet Union to lead a joint session on the rule of law. There he shared with them the importance of individual rights, freedom of contract, and private property. Tomorrow he travels to Budapest for a similar conference. In these meetings, he speaks not only for President Bush, but for all Americans in championing these principles, whether applied here in the United States, in Eastern Europe, or the Soviet Union, as the foundation of free and democratic societies. It is with great honor that I introduce Attorney General Dick Thornburgh.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you all for a warm welcome, and my congratulations to those of you who have arranged this conference at a very propitious and important time. To you, Mr. Lieutenant Governor, I extend my thanks for a beautiful gift. There is something about giving a timepiece to a speaker that is somewhat unsubtle, I would say. I remember being told by Senator Hugh Scott, who was one of my mentors in Pennsylvania politics when I began getting into public life and had occasion to speak, he said, always keep an eye on your audience. He said, you'll notice that some people out there, as you proceed through your remarks, will be looking at their watches. That's a sign. But the sign to really get off the platform is they begin shaking their watch as if it doesn't work. On this date in 1874 was born Winston Churchill, perhaps England's greatest prime minister. In 1946 at Westminster College in Missouri, Churchill took note in a famous speech of what he called the Iron Curtain that had descended over Eastern Europe from Stettin on the Baltic to Trieste on the Adriatic, as he noted. Today, that Iron Curtain is gone. And we are able to gather here today with our colleagues from here and from Eastern Europe to discuss the rule of law in Eastern Europe and how Churchill would have loved to enter into such a dialogue and discussion, and how vindicated he must have felt by the events of this last 2 years. For me, it is a distinct honor to address another gathering of the Federalist Society, this time here in New Orleans, to bring a little federalism to the Delta, and to have the opportunity to talk once again about such an abidingly important topic as the rule of law. After freedom, it is, as another great British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher has said, the essential underpinning of democracy. But the rule of law is also what invariably marks the final break with tyranny. The rule of law is what shears any rising democracy clean from the rule of men, which so easily becomes the overrule of dangerous men. During these next 2 days, you will be examining that shearing away process in Eastern Europe as communist rule disappears and new governments arise. And judging in your own right how realistic are its chances for a clean break from past tyranny. To say, as we have already noted, that chances vary from country to country, and overall, with the yet undecided fate of democracy in the Soviet Union, is to state the obvious about a disequilibrium that has long plagued East Central Europe. And I hasten to say that I do not come here posing as any kind of country expert, since two of those countries, Bulgaria and Hungary, I will be visiting for the first time myself beginning tomorrow. Rather, what I hope to offer comes out of my own direct experience expounding the rule of law within the Soviet Union, and what I hope further to add are lessons we have learned at the Department of Justice by continuing to explore these vital questions with our Soviet counterparts and with representatives of the Russian Republic and other republics, as well as with many other legal officials inside other former Eastern Europe bloc countries. On that basis, I believe I can offer one initial generalization, actually by way of a joke that the Poles have been telling upon themselves. After this week's election for their presidency, I'm sure we all recognize the dilemma that Poland faces. Lech Wałęsa, the populist leader of Solidarity, must now face off against a free market capitalist of Peruvian-Canadian citizenship. That election saw the free exercise of the franchise, but it leaves the country even more ill-ordered. Whoever now wins must still face the daunting task that Polish wits have defined as distinguishing between an aquarium and fish soup. You can always make fish soup out of an aquarium, they will tell you in Warsaw, but it is much harder to make an aquarium out of fish soup. In these Polish terms, you might say that most, if not all, of Eastern Europe is one big bowl of fish chowder. In varying degrees, freedom has been precariously won, but democracy has yet to be established or reestablished. Somewhere in Middle Europa's historical memory bank, records of democratic institutions, such as free and representative parliaments, must exist, but they are exceedingly hard to access. Even now, the nomenklatura tries to hide the code after their tyranny has all but dismantled the legal culture that once gave these institutions their living context. They're indeed, in many cases, Western grounding. Years of oppression have taught Eastern Europeans what Adam Michnik calls an acquired helplessness. So that despite new freedom, some political movements among the peoples of Eastern Europe tend to be irredentist, not a leap forward, but a hearkening back particularly to national and religious instincts. Such longings are understandable and neither, I hasten to say, are necessarily in error. Democracy can abide a strong commitment to nationalism, even regionalism, and religion has often been the inspiration for our democratic beliefs. But joined narrowly as one, nationalism and religion can together form great terror. The worst of Nazism, it should be recalled, had its grotesque foreshadowings in the post-World War I politics of Eastern Europe. Indeed, one function of the rule of law is to create a sphere of government at separate removes from nationalism and religion. The rule of law protects basic human rights against everything, from arbitrary government to mob persecution. It assures that society does not sink to the show trial or the pogrom or the concentration camp. But more than that, the rule of law guarantees the process whereby democratic institutions can rise, grow, change, and flourish. Due process of law underpins such differing institutions as the free marketplace and the representative legislature, the fair tax roll and the uncensored newspaper, the privacy of conscience and the sanctity of domicile. All of these and more of ordinary commerce are protected by the rule of law and its built-in arbiter, the independent judiciary. That is why, amidst the struggles of inchoate democratic institutions to be born or reborn since 1989, the call so often has gone up for the rule of law. We first heard it explicitly from Mikhail Gorbachev in his early demand for a law-based society. We heard it most recently during the Polish election, usually from Lech Wałęsa's opponents. Sometimes for any law, even discredited communist law, so long as precedent might rule over incipient anarchy. The call for the rule of law is both desperate and inspiring because, as wiser heads understand, it is the only way out of the soup. Let me take a first rough cut at the countries in question. If we leave East Germany to the Germans, Albania as one of the last rundown communist theme parks, and Yugoslavia as a mature Comintern expatriate since 1948, there remain five prospects for the rule of law in Eastern Europe. Three of them, Hungary, Poland, and Czechoslovakia, have already experienced genuine political revolution, both in the streets and at the polls, and offer viable political choices to their electorates. The other two, Romania and Bulgaria, are still significantly influenced by the nomenklatura. Until only yesterday, when the Bulgarians forced the supposedly socialist government out of office. And this holds great promise. Back in September, I met at the Department of Justice with President Zhelev of Bulgaria, who leads the Union of Democratic Forces opposition, and who has now called upon the Bulgarian National Assembly today to take up anew the drafting of a new constitution. President Zhelev's visiting party came to talk with us about the rule of law. They now have before them a draft constitution. Bernard Segan of San Diego. The Segan draft contains a most impressive bill of personal rights. All of Article 10, including a prohibition against politics organized as religion in Section 1.3, and a lock-solid guarantee of property rights through Section 5. And this may be a good omen for the future of Bulgarian democracy. But while I will gather my own impressions when I visit Sofia next week, I'm still much inclined to believe that the interest in property rights, for example, derives from more immediate self-interest beyond legal reform, such as we first found among the Soviets. Let me explain. It's clear that the Soviets face one great dire urgency besides growing nationalistic unrest, and that is their economy. To survive, they must ultimately enter the world marketplace, the free world marketplace. And to do that, they realize they must position themselves to recognize and take advantage of the rules of free commerce. The rule of law, I suggest, is a fundamental prerequisite for turning away from the command economy to the market economy. Soviet leaders now comprehend that without meaningful structural changes, their nation cannot be competitive with other powerful global economies. To achieve this, the Soviets recognize as well that they must display the predictability and stability that can only emerge from a body of commercial law, which in turn respects the sanctity of contracts and, yes, recognizes property rights as well. Fear of abrogation of contract rights or expropriation of investments, they realize, will stunt even the most otherwise attractive commercial, financial, and industrial opportunities. So the Soviets' principal reason for their great interest in the rule of law, in my view, is their immediate and pressing need to stabilize their economy, to establish something approximating a normal economy. They also understand as a corollary, they must respect human rights. If Jackson-Vanik restrictions on trade are to be lifted, and they are to enjoy most favored nation status, they must do so in order to jumpstart their participation in the world economy and to attract foreign know-how and investment. Likewise, only more so, with these Eastern European countries. They, too, are broke. They, too, must find ways to attract Western investment and to compete in the world economy. That is why it's entirely understandable that the other surviving Polish candidate for president should be a challenging, entrepreneurial Westerner. Again, the rule of law is understood as the necessary pillar for commercial progress. And the deeper a country becomes involved in East-West commerce, the farther you will find that society is coming in developing its own rule of law. I will also be visiting Hungary next week, where supporters of so-called goulash communism just lost an election to the proponents of a more advanced capitalism. More than any other Eastern European society, and over a longer period, Hungary has been entering into joint ventures with the West. So I consider it no surprise that Hungary is also the only polity that has established a committee for constitutional review of its laws. Like a similar committee in the Soviet Union, this Hungarian committee's opinion is only advisory, not binding. But setting up even some form of judicial review is a giant step toward guaranteeing the rule of law over the rule of men. We at the Department of Justice have frankly been encouraging such developments wherever we can, responding to every legitimate request. We are heartened by Eastern European interest in our antitrust laws, for example. Both Poland and Hungary have sought our advice on how to keep their struggling markets commercially free of private monopoly and price fixing. Also, we have joined the Soviets in discussions on environmental law and now see that we might help Eastern Europe curb the environmental pollution that often engenders that heavy gray death pall over their cities. We believe economic incentives are the best means to end industrial pollution and are prepared to argue that case through the newly established Budapest Regional Environmental Center for Central and Eastern Europe. But committed as we are to this democratizing course, I cannot deny that atavistic forces still work against the rule of law. Eastern Europe's acquired helplessness is backed by xenophobia, ingrained by communist rule, and deepened by narrow but often fanatic ethnic loyalties. Many diverse peoples still express their root longings in a nostalgia for the rule of men, sometimes in hero worship for past leaders, some of dubious glory. Yes, we must be aware that the fate of Eastern Europe remains ambiguous, unclear, and that continuing democratization is no foregone conclusion. We must stoutly proclaim our adherence to the rule of law, our faith in the free market, and not shrink from stating the social consequences that both may entail. Too often, democracy is grasped as simply an add-on to previous entitlements. People do not understand that a new birth of freedom may mean the surcease not only of tyranny, but also of subsidy. Confusion mounts out of the daily shortfall, turning to nativist bitterness and resurgent political anger, and indeed sometimes to chaos. The Poles again have a word for it, Ciemnograd. It means the city of darkness, a place where backwardness and superstition reign. It has been a recurrent fear in that country since the 19th century, and our great hope must remain that democratic enlightenment, the torch of freedom, trimmed by the rule of law, will force back the shadows that still threaten to spread such a city of darkness across Eastern Europe. How then do we presently help further democratic enlightenment? How do we, so to speak, spread the rule of law? First, we should start by recognizing that such rejuvenations of democracy have occurred successfully elsewhere in Europe. The recent examples of Spain and Portugal should not be overlooked, nor the grand lesson learned from the post-war democratization of Germany, where a conquered people, in economic extremists at a moment of deep disillusionment with their own society, managed with our considerable help to overcome the considerable obstacles of a truly totalitarian past. I believe, in fact, that we tend to worry less today about a united Germany's future because we feel we can count on the West Germans to pass along to their Eastern counterparts these very same early lessons in democracy. Second, we must do all we can to help Eastern Europe cultivate a legal culture. And that will have to be done at the expense of what remains of the nomenklatura, who have been politically adroit at exploiting the post-1989 vacuum of power in many instances. For once, one can speak of too few lawyers, or worse, lawyers trained solely as apparatchiks to serve, in effect, as paralegals to the secret police. From our own history, we sometimes forget how well-grounded our revolutionaries were in the rule of law. In 1775, Edmund Burke warned the British Parliament in arguing our grievances what George III was up against: lawyers and smatterers in the law. Blackstone was an American bestseller, and these colonials displayed a fierce spirit of liberty. In other countries, Burke noted, people judge of an ill principle in government only by an actual grievance, but not these crazy Americans. Here, they anticipate the evil and judge the pressure of the grievance by the badness of the principle. They augur misgovernment at a distance and sniff the approach of tyranny in every tainted cloud. Something of that fierce and informed spirit of liberty, buried in the liberal traditions of the academies in Prague and Warsaw, and even in the vaults of Sofia, must rise again for the principled cause of the rule of law. Third, we must continue to help by resources, but perhaps more by patience and example and even some advocacy, all those who seek to establish the rule of law. in trade negotiations, on environmental matters, in international criminal investigations, and on international drug control, now operative under a United Nations treaty. We should do all we can to ground our Eastern European partners in a new respect for the rule of law. And projects such as the Library of Democracy, undertaken by Allen and the Center for Democracy, can be a positive leadership exemplar in this regard, to share the words and phrases and thoughts of our own democratic tradition in explicit, understandable, translated editions of those true classics of democracy. And let me emphasize, above all else, that property rights are key both to the revival of their fragile economies and the survival of their newfound freedoms. We should be speaking out, as did our own Sons of Liberty, on the eve of the revolution, for liberty and property. And finally, we must understand that, like everybody else's experiment in democracy, and ours still is a grand and glorious experiment, theirs in Eastern Europe must be achieved within their own societies. Each can hold back the city of darkness through its own democratic enlightenment. And we cannot count upon such enlightenment simply to arise as virtue triumphant from the totalitarian ruins of Eastern Europe. Such ruins have left their societies too weakened and too vulnerable. Remember, in October, it only took a taxi strike across the bridges between Buda and Pest to bring all of Hungary to a halt. Even where democratic enlightenment seems likely to prevail, the rule of law will be formalized differently, as we've noted, by the Czechs or the Poles or the Hungarians, and most certainly by the Romanians and Bulgars. Nobody else but their own lawyers, government ministers, judges, and citizens can evolve the judicial fairness and institute the legal restraint that underpin any rule of law. And it is only inherent respect for the law, such as their people have demanded in the open squares and open parliaments and newly opened societies, that will finally shear away the last vestiges of communist tyranny. In sum, I suggest only the rule of law can provide a sturdy bridge over the yawning political chasm between current upheaval and future democracy. And we will know it when and if it appears. By the human rights the rule of law protects, by the governmental powers the rule of law limits, by the judicial independence the rule of law preserves. We will know it constitutionally when we see it. And after more than 200 years of experience and experiment on our own, who better to judge its emergence elsewhere? I thank you for giving me the opportunity to offer these observations at the beginning of what can be truly an exciting and historic gathering. And I wish you well during the balance of your meetings during the next 2 days. Thank you all very much.